This is Scott Allen from odecoded.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Coon from lazycoder.com.
Hello and welcome to Herding Code. This episode is being recorded on March 24, 2009. Tonight we're going to talk to Sean Wildermuth about Rhea services and maybe some other Silverlight 3 stuff. So Sean, can you introduce yourself, please?
Sure. As he said, I'm Sean Wildermuth. I run the Silverlight Tour and an Agile train, and have been around Silverlight for longer than I like to admit. And before that, I was kind of a data hound. So that's who I am.
Okay. So the first question we all had was, you know, how exactly do you explain what is Rhea services?
It's magic. The whole idea behind Rhea services is pretty simple. They want to be able to create a server-side service where you can annotate metadata about rules, and mostly validation rules, but also some other types of rules, and have that communicate to a client tier, whether that's WPF or Silverlight, or maybe even at some point JavaScript, and have those rules embedded in that client-side proxy, if you will. And that's the big goal of what it's trying to do. The way it works in the bits that you can get today are somewhat magical in that you write these domain objects on the server side and it magically creates them on the client side, which we'll discuss a little later is one of the problems I have personally with it. But that has been promised to be fixed. Does that give you a good, you know, elevator pitch for what it's trying to do?
Sure. So I'm thinking before we, like, one obvious question, you know, is this good magic or bad magic? But I think before we dig into that, we should talk about, like, specifically what's going on under the hood. So I mean, a lot of what it's doing, it's generating these proxy classes, right?
Yes. And in early bits, they were inventing their own on-the-wire protocol. And since then, they've decided to use ADO.NET Data Services or WCF to really handle the communication across the tier. Because in general, Rhea services is about going out to Silverlight primarily. And so what you have in that case is a richer client and a rich client that needs something for line of business apps. This is very focused and very sharply focused towards line of business apps. Now, one of the questions that's come up over and over and over again as I've talked about this is what is a line of business app? Let's actually step back and talk about that before we get into Rhea services, because different people have different opinions. You know, is a line of business app an application for your employees in an enterprise, and a line of business app a B2B sort of story that's going across or out of the firewall, or is it could it even be B2C like in the famous airline Silverlight demo we see? And I think all three of them are really line of business apps. And so making the decision about how you have rich server-side data as well as rules and how you communicate that to the client is the large, laudable goal. Now, the problem with the magic is it's really watching every time you make a change and on the server and immediately changing the client. Now, that makes a very sexy demo. Ooh, I make a change and it automatically is in the client. The problem with that is it's too much magic. So that assumes that most applications and most line of business apps are going to be two-tiered. There's going to be a client tier and a server tier and nothing else. Well, probably a database somewhere in the back end, but that you're not going to be building or componentizing larger applications because this assumes that there's always this Visual Studio relationship between the two. You see this a lot in the web service space where they're using something like an add surface reference to allow not only the application that's in the solution, but also other solutions to point at those services.
So, Sean, would it be safe to assume that Rhea services would be something that we'd use when you control both sides of the wire?
Absolutely. And you control both sides of the wire not only in the .NET to .NET space, but also where you want to have your logic written once. And the promise here is that we can take that logic that's written on the server and use it in the client in a smart way, and that Rhea services is going to simplify that for us. Simplify it in that you're not going to have to think about, oh, this code is going to be generated for me on the client, so I have to write it in a certain way, but simply just write your domain objects in that they'll handle making Silverlight-specific code for you. Now, one thing to note is that Microsoft wants a lot of feedback about RIA services. And the reason is, it's really pretty early. RIA services is not a Silverlight 3 deliverable. It is a post-Silverlight 3. Does that mean Silverlight 4? Does that mean an independent release between 3 and 4? I don't know. They don't know. But it's certainly not going to be in the RTW bits.
Maybe, could we drill down like to a specific scenario? Let's say I have in my database an employee table, and I have in C# code an employee entity that represents the records that are going to be brought back from that table. What does that look like when it goes over the wire and gets into Silverlight and we allow a user to edit the employee class?
Sure. Depending on the type of transport, WCF, WCF REST, or ADO.NET Data Services, that can look fairly different. ADO.NET Data Services, it's going to look like an ATOM contract. WCF, it's going to look like a SOAP call. And REST, it's going to look like a serialized XML. So what it actually looks like over the wire, it isn't that interesting. It's actually earlier than that when it's actually exchanging metadata. Because when you're exchanging an employee, the magic that they're adding to the equation isn't how you get an entity across the wire. We know how to do that, and that's not difficult. The really hard part is, how do you exchange metadata about rules? In your employee example, your employee may have last name and first name as required fields, middle name is not required. It may have a length specification for how long the Social Security number is supposed to be, or government ID, and that sort of thing, and what a primary key looks like so that when they're created on the client that they can actually be represented as keys on the server. And so it's that type of ancillary metadata, not schema, larger than that. It's not. We're already communicating with existing technologies schema. We don't need to do that again.
So what's the level of flexibility or the level of sophistication around these sort of rules that you're encoding? I mean, rules in a, you know, in a domain sense, in a domain-driven sense, can be very complex. What's that level of depth there?
Today it's somewhat shallow. They've purposefully decided that there are certain types of rules that they can handle in metadata, required length, that sort of thing. They can handle fairly straightforward. So when you get into more complex rules, rules that are define things like the relationship or check values with different entities that are much harder to define, and those are the things they're trying to solve now. Most of what they're doing today are more of the validation sort of rules that we're going to be talking about. You're not talking about really business rules on the whole, though that's certainly the laudable long-term goal. I don't imagine that they're going to have a great solution for that. This isn't a new problem, right? We've had this problem for years and years and years. We've solved it until relatively recently by just building business objects over our data layers or domain objects over our data access or schema and sharing those with all of our code. But now that we're throwing a firewall in the middle of there, it gets more complicated. We're not necessarily writing .NET code on both sides of the wire. If we are, we have the Silverlight desktop .NET disconnection problem. You have a mini BCL versus a full BCL. And so it's becoming harder and harder to share those objects. And that's what it's trying to solve. That's why it's called RIA services and not validation or metadata services. It's trying to solve this particular problem that they're hoping it will extend beyond the Silverlight story.
In Nikhil's demo for during his talk at Mix09, he did show some things where he was like, there is code, like during a save event, you say, you know, before saving or before fetching, you know, check access or that kind of thing. So it does seem like there's some places where you can intercept the code and say, no, I only want to show products that are on sale, or I don't want to allow editing products unless you're an administrator or that kind of thing, right?
Well, yes, and that's actually, they're getting a lot of that for free because that support is already in ADO.NET Data Services. And so being able to create interceptors is one of the things they're doing there. One of the reasons I'm kind of pushing the team and have been pushing for, frankly, about 7 months to move towards ADO.NET Data Services as that middle glue, because we're getting a lot of that interception story for free. And you're not necessarily creating lots and lots of message-based protocols to mimic a CRUD interface, which is, you know, one of the reasons I've been hot and heavy on ADO.NET services in general, using the RIA layer on top of it to get more metadata about actually how the validation happens and other rules, I think, is the important step here. And no one's ever done this right as far as I'm concerned. We've looked at a lot of different situations where we tried to share that metadata across the wire, and it's difficult. It's a hard, hard problem. Because if it were just required fields and lengths, who cares? We could probably handle that in a number of different ways, share an XML file with the rules and that sort of thing. But doing the hard rules is the big problem. We were having a conversation with Rocky Latka today, and you know, it's not, you know, he was very right in this fact. Good business rules, not just validation rules, are what we really need. But that's, I don't think that's in the card for V1. That's just my opinion. Certainly, Brad Abrams might have a different opinion on that. But from the bits I've seen, that's where we're sitting with Rhea Services today.
So is it already time for a vote of no confidence on Rhea Services? Do I have to go to petition.com?
I really hope not. No, actually, the interesting part of the story for me is, even though I'm in on the early betas or alphas or whatever you want to call it from the team on this, I've been saying the same things I've said at Mix and after Mix about Rhea Services, is that their intention isn't flawed. I think some of their implementation is a problem now, and now that they heard from a ton of people what I'd been telling them for months, I think that's actually making some difference. I got Brad Abrams to commit to do two very big changes from the current bits, and I've actually quoted him, and I'm going to push and hold him accountable to this. One is that they're going to make sure that the integration with ADR.NET Data Services is a full-stack integration. I've actually talked to both sides, Pablo Castro as well as Brad Abrams, about this to make sure it happens, because, you know, Microsoft being a political machine, you always have to make sure that everyone's playing nice. And the other, which is to me more important, and that is to dismiss some of the magic. For people that are building a simple, you know, two-piece app, I have a web piece and I have a RAA piece, using the magic they have built in isn't really a problem. I'm not a fan of it, but it's not really a problem. But he's assured me by RTM that they'll have the ad service reference style relationship to the Rhea Services, so that you can have larger componentized Silverlight apps, which are becoming the norm as far as I'm concerned. You're seeing much less one monolithic app, and that's why things like Prism and some other technologies are getting a good use inside the Silverlight space. And until we have Rhea Services that really supports those sorts of scenarios, it's only going to be used. It's going to become another, oh, good, we have another rapid application development tool that isn't useful to anyone building real apps. And hopefully the commitment I got from Brad that wouldn't be the case for 1.0.
Hey, guys. This is Rachel. I'm sitting here with Scott Allen, and we're at ASP Connections. So I was just kind of hanging out and listening to the podcast. And I have a question for Sean. Sean, how might we approach some of these techniques that you're talking about with validation and working with N-tier development in Silverlight, if you've come from a traditional ASP.NET background? What kind of advice might you have for some of us who are doing that?
Well, in a lot of ways, you're going to think about the client tier, the Silverlight tier, much like you did the web tier, because that's really where most of your code's going to get written. You're still going to end up writing a service tier of some sort. And in ASP.NET, that was never clear, the separation from that. You had ASPX pages and you had ASMX pages next to each other, and they all felt like they were in the web tier, though logically they were never really thought of or really never constructed in that way. And so people coming from that space, you can think about your client tier really being in the client, being running in the browser. And so there's a certain difference there, because you're crossing a firewall at some point to get at your code, which is much different than in the ASP.NET space. But at the end of the day, you're still using services, and especially if you've done Ajax, you've already done that client problem. Now, to solve this, you have a richer model than you had in JavaScript. So how do you solve that? You know, one of the ways I teach in the class is to today, with today's tools, without Rhea Services, is to do a code share, where you have a business object or a domain object that has some of that validation that you're actually sharing and compiling once in Silverlight and once in on the server side. And that way you can bring some of that logic over without writing it twice. It's compiled twice, but we're not writing it twice. Rhea Services promises a better story than that, but we're not certainly not quite there.
So just to follow up on something you were saying earlier, I mean, when I hear this story, it sets my draggy droppy spider sense a tingling. You know, are we talking about just, as you say, a rad tool that, like, demos well for selling Visual Studio, but when you actually try to build real complex apps with complex logic, it like falls down. What prevents us from heading down that route?
It's really up to us to push that, because, you know, the real story here is, do we know whether this works with real apps out in the field? No. You know, we've had it a week, right, at least in the public sphere. We don't know whether it scales up well. We don't know whether it works well with large teams and some of those other problems. And source control, you know, we don't know any of those stories well, whether they're going to work in these larger environments. But the reality is that most of what it's doing is somewhat transparent. I mean, they've certainly built some things that I'm appreciative of. You can certainly build your domain objects and use attributes to annotate them, which I'm not a huge fan of. Attributes, even though they're supposed to be just metadata, involve a lot of coupling with different parts of the system. They've built it so that you can supply your metadata in really any way you want. One of the things I'm working with the team on is building an Hibernate provider, and that Hibernate provider will provide as much of that metadata as it can using an Hibernate metadata instead of attributes, for instance. You know, I think the story is we don't know. I would ask the people that are listening to this podcast to go get the code, start looking at it, start playing with it, and be very critical. Go out there and give as much feedback back to the group as you can, because it's the only. This is our chance to affect change. Once 1.0 gets released or even gets into a real beta cycle as we approach RTW of 3.0, I think we're going to lose time. And so until people like you guys that are passionate about whether this is going to work or not, this is our window. This is our 3 to 6 month window to make a change.
So, Sean, you mentioned Anhibernate as a possibility, and is that just because it's possible as SQL Server Data Services or ADO.NET Data Services that you can extend? What's the extensibility story? Like, what kind of data sources can I use?
Well, to date, this is a little confusing because they're attaching both of these models, the ADO.NET Data Services story as well as the WCF story. In the WCF story, WCF is going to be responsible for all the data access as you were. And so you're going to write code to actually do that, just like you would with WCF services today. On the ADO.NET Data Services side, let's just call it Data Services. On the Data Services side, Data Services uses any link provider that has the right hooks into it. I wrote the provider for Anhibernate. There's one for EF. There's one for Simple Objects. There's one for Link to SQL, and there's one for LLBGen Pro. I'm sure there's some others out there, but those are the four or five that I'm paying close attention to. And so as long as they can transmit that schema up or that metadata up, they'll be able to add that. What is required in the RIA services to support and Hibernate some of these others is to add that next level of metadata, the rules metadata, and that's where the provider comes in to add some extra features on top of the existing link provider in Hibernate or EF to supply those. And whether they're reading them out of XML files or attributes or INI files, it doesn't really matter because they're getting it into a form that they can transmit across the wire.
See, and that kind of touches on on one of the problems that I have with it, just from what little I've heard. The big disclaimer here is that I've not downloaded the tool and tried it or done anything with it. Heck, I just now got to get to use MVC in a production environment. I'm just happy with that. But it seems like that they're putting they've kind of developed this in their little Microsoft vacuum where, you know, they don't actually write applications with it. They just build frameworks and figure that third parties will come along and fill in the gaps that they can't think of because they all came in straight out of college. And what they're really concentrating on is all the plumbing code. And the plumbing code, the wiring up the stuff to the database, is not where the interesting and the hard stuff happens. If you're used to using an ORM, and I don't care if you use Anhibernate or Link to SQL or whatever, if you're doing that, you're not really concerned about wiring things up. You're concerned about what happens between the user interface and the database. And it just seems like this is going to be more plumbing code that is either auto-genned that we then have to go fix, or it's going to be stuff that we have to write so that we can hook up our ORM to our UI, yet more. And that's kind of the real problem that I have with this concept is I don't need something that helps me write plumbing code or tries to write plumbing code for me and then requires me to work around it. I need something that gets out of my way. And on the other hand, it looks like it could be a way of just fooling the UI into thinking that it's really only two tiers, which, you know, is what you're trying to do if you're writing, you know, end-tier applications anyway. You're trying to just, you know, the tier should not know anything more than the tier above it in the best case scenario. And so that's kind of why I was excited to, you know, get Sean on. And I listened to the .NET Rocks podcast with Nikhil and Brad some this afternoon, as much as I could take at least. Before I just, you know, I kind of listened to it and I said, God, that's just, you know, that's just more of the same. And you can do it without writing any code that we've been hearing since VB3. Or, you know, let's go all the way back to Quick Basic. No, you had to write code with Quick Basic, I'm pretty sure. So am I off base, or, you know, is it just too early to tell? Or, and more importantly, why should I really care? I mean, I'm kind of passionate about the things that Microsoft puts out and that the effect that they have in the community. But on another hand, I don't really care if people want to strangle themselves with these, you know, crappy tools. I just won't use them. And if, you know, I'm in a situation where I don't get to, you know, use tools that I want, then I'll look for another place. It's already happened a couple of times. So I guess why should I, you know, am I way off base just because I don't have any real experience with this stuff? Is this just my knee-jerk reaction?
Well, I think what you've said is somewhat unfair, because most of the guys I know on the team I have a lot of respect for. That's not true for all the teams in Microsoft, and no, I won't tell you what teams I think those are. But I do think that the team understands the problems they're facing and understand they're not doing actually a lot of plumbing code. They're layering this over other parts of the framework that we're already using and some people are enjoying using that already do that. You know, ORM magic. None of what RA does has anything to do with ORM. And that's the important idea here, is don't assume that this is, oh, we have a sixth type of data access inside of .NET now. And that's not true. It's, in a lot of ways, it's in the same spirit as data services, because data services isn't responsible for any data access. All they do is they translate what the user wants in the form of a URI query and translate that into a link query. That's all it does. And in a lot of ways, you can think of RIA in the same way. It's a fairly thin layer that says, I know how to create code on the client that is going to include the rules that I've defined on the server already. Because most people in these cases already have those rules defined on the server, right? Whether you've got business objects or you have written hand-parsed code to do it, as any data comes in across the wire, you have to be the gatekeeper to your database, make sure those rules are valid, whether they're simple validation rules or whether they're complex business rules. Essentially, the idea behind RIA services is a thin layer to provide a way to generate code on the client that has the same sort of rules on the server. And that's all it is. We've certainly, on the server, you have to have the gatekeeper to make sure those rules are enforced. This is a way to allow us to enforce them on the client so we don't have to make the round trip just to find out our data is invalid. This isn't anything new under the sun. It's simply they're trying to provide a way to do that. And of all the, I would encourage everybody on the call and everybody listening to this, go get the bits. There may be things you absolutely hate. There may be things that you'll be surprised that you actually like about what they're trying to do. I don't think fundamentally what they're trying to do is a bad thing. It's not time for no confidence or anything like that. I especially if you haven't looked at it, it's very hard to be critical of it, because the guys I've talked to on the team, and I've talked to a number of them, I'm pretty impressed with, and I want to give them the best chance to succeed. And this isn't going to be a layer for everybody. This isn't going to be what every Silverlight app is written in. There are lots and lots of cases where the domain object you have on the server, you need to do certain things with it on the client that are very specialized. You know, one of the things that this implies, you know, even if you're using WCF or data services or hand-coded REST or whatever, is we're in a fundamentally different place. When we're dealing with multi-tier or client-server apps, where we're going essentially using our own code to go to the database. We had some of these same problems, but we didn't need to be concerned with overuse of data. And the overuse of data isn't about bandwidth, like some people might consider. It's actually about safety. If I'm writing a sales application, and that sales application needs data about the salesman and the sales they've made so that I can look and see what the trends are, or how much we're going to pay out in commission, or whatever the case is, those sales objects may have in them implicitly, in the business object that were written a year ago for them, information like their home address and their social security number and other data that you don't want necessarily crossing the wire. Because it's not only, you know, certainly you could use SSL to protect that data against eavesdroppers, but what about protecting it from the user? Do I want the other salespeople or even the sales manager to have access to that private data? Maybe not. When you get outside of your enterprise and start talking about B2B and B2C, this becomes even more important. So the data objects we're used to passing around as full domain objects, we may be passing around summary data in many more occasions with SilverLight just because it's a smaller surface area to be wary of.
This thing about, you know, I think we have been, as you alluded to earlier, we've been spoiled by writing web apps for years now, and we've kind of acted like it's all really, I mean, we may partition our code out and use some patterns, but we're all running on one tier, you know, and so now that we're running on multiple tiers, we need to think about, you know, keeping our data in the right place and on which tier and how we get it back and forth and how, you know, what kind of data transfer objects we use and that kind of stuff. And
how to secure that data.
Exactly. And
well, no, wait a second. What do you mean by tier? You mean just physical box?
Physical box. Physical network, you know, like where you are on the layer, because that SilverLight code is running on your client, you know, on your end user's machine, and they can attach a debugger to that process. You know what I'm saying? So it's, you may do things in your...
So SilverLight is flawed. No, you can do the same thing with JavaScript, though.
Sure.
Right.
Sure, exactly. And that was actually my next point, was the whole idea of, like, some of this is not addressing new problems. These are actually things that everyone's been rolling their own for Ajax apps. You know, I mean, I ran into this naively on a web app a couple of years ago where I was, you know, there was a requirement that the design team came up with to use a Ajax login, you know, and pretty soon I'm like, well, this is not an easy problem and it's not really a good, you know, I mean, this is a complex issue here. And so I'm wondering, that was one of the things Nikhil pointed out, was that technically, or, you know, that's part of the design, is that this is not only a SilverLight solution, that this could actually be used for Ajax as well. I just wondered what you thought of that, Sean, if you think that is actually applicable.
I don't know how much they're positioning towards that, but absolutely. I mean, you see this across the Microsoft, you know, developers or whatever you want to call it, in that they're building a lot of things for SilverLight that then become part of the whole ecosystem. You can see that with Deep Zoom. You can see that with Azure.NET Data Services, etc. They're saying that we should have full facility for JavaScript-based, SilverLight-based, and rich client-based. Though, honestly, and certainly a lot of WPF guys I've been listening to lately are scared to death that the rich client one is probably getting the least love right now. Rich client meaning WPF and WinForms, not RAA.
Maybe they should have bet on a winning horse.
I think SharePoint has to be the most rich of all clients, right?
To some respect, I mean, interestingly, the jQuery and the SilverLight story in SharePoint is actually not a bad one. Yeah, I see a lot of people, for some one reason or another, Atlanta is a fairly rich SharePoint ecosystem. So even though I refuse to code in SharePoint, I certainly run into those guys and we have those conversations about it. And so they're using a lot of those same tiers that we're talking about in SharePoint as well. So as much as I would like to badmouth them, I really can't get away with it because they're using the stuff that I care about as well. They're just using it in small web parts instead of whole pages or SilverLight apps and that sort of thing.
So, Sean, if I wanted to use test-driven design to build out my entities and my classes for RIA services, what sort of obstacles would I face? Do you know?
I don't, because I haven't tried to apply some of those patterns. Certainly using something like SilverUnit or the SilverLight test framework from the toolkit guys, you can certainly run tests against your Silverlight data. How that especially applies to the RIA stuff, I'm not deep enough in it to give you a smart answer.
Okay. Because I did look at Nikhil's recent post, and he did have a sample project that you could download from his mixed presentation, and he said he wasn't able to, he didn't have time to cover this in his mixed presentation, but in the sample project you could download, he did have a unit testing project, and it was kind of light, but it did sort of show that the domain services were POCOs, and it was fairly easy, it looked like, to stub those things out or mock those things out. So that was a sort of encouraging from someone that wants to practice TDD against this. But, you know, the concern of anyone who's doing TDD is that if there's any sort of Visual Studio magic or MS Build magic or any sort of magic that's outside of your control in the unit test, that's going to create complications.
Well, certainly Silverlight is unit testable, and I like to separate the two concepts, TDD versus unit testing, because you can do unit and functional and even to some respect assurance testing in Silverlight. Whether that workflow really works with the TDD fail first mentality is a part that I can't speak really strongly to. It's not something that I've spent a lot of time with, but certainly doing those tests in Silverlight are a challenge because they're kind of this isolated domain. There's a, you know, their own CLR and all of that. You're running in a browser, and so running them has been a challenge, but we've had some frameworks. I'll again point out the Silverlight test framework that comes with the Silverlight toolkit, as well as the Silver unit stuff, which both of them I like as good solutions to solve those. Now, the problem with the workflow is because there is code generation of client code from changing of server code, that means that in your TDD flow, you're going to be writing and mocking up objects that will exist later and then maybe changing those tests as you're writing server code, and that workflow feels weird to me in a TDD sense. So there is some magic there.
Sure, and you know, one thing that's kind of always bothered me about Silverlight is that if I wanted to do true unit tests about on the code that I have in a Silverlight project, I'd have to link those files into a unit testing project. And it always seemed to me that, you know, maybe Microsoft could come up with some sort of cross compilation strategy so I could have stuff in a project that could compile into Silverlight. You know, if one flag was set, or compile into just the desktop CLR if another flag was set, and that way I could run a unit test against it. Instead of this approach of, let's write some code and we'll, you know, generate stuff all the time or perform some other sort of magic.
That certainly makes sense, though, your supposition that having a switch where you could test it on .NET for code that's going to be compiled in Silverlight, those tests would be completely useless as far as I'm concerned, because until it runs on the actual code it's going to run on, what is the test worth?
True. Yeah, I mean, difference of opinion. I think there could be some value there.
Yeah, I don't disagree. I think you're going to see more of frameworks come out that will allow you to do real unit testing. Certainly the Silverlight toolkit stuff has this notion of separate projects. I've been told, though I haven't had a chance to look deeply into trying to get this to work, that the Silverlight unit stuff is supposed to be a bit better with that. It's supposed to be more of a true unit test framework and not kind of this unit test framework plus a kind of a GUI tester at the same time. And that's kind of the hole we're missing from it right now.
So I think all of us have been trained, you know, like Kevin and others have pointed out earlier on the call, to kind of be wary of magic in .NET and Visual Studio and just Microsoft tools in general. And I think that a lot of people would assume that, like, the experience is, you know, you go in your Server Explorer, you find your table, you drop it on a Silverlight form, you get a table, you right-click, customize columns, and hit F5, which is not the case. But can you talk about the actual kind of, like, user workflow of, like, how I go ahead, you know, how I would hook up a data source and make it available in a Silverlight app?
Well, I think this is one of the fundamental confusions, is that you're going to at some point create domain objects by drag and dropping tables someplace. Because understand that RIA is that layer above all of that, that you should have an object model or a model, whether it's an object model or not, but a model that you're going to expose out to a Silverlight client or to a RIA services client. Now, whether you built that with and hibernate using, you know, traditional methods, or you built that with EF by dragging tables over. You built it with Link to SQL by doing all of its GUI magic. It doesn't matter because you're really saying, I have the data tier down here that knows how to get and set data in the database, knows how to deal with the concurrency magic that I need to worry about. And then above that, I'm writing RIA services, and I'm going to add, I'm going to pull in data from the model, and I'm going to add to it my rules on top of it. So we're talking about traditionally at the business object level, not at the DAO level. And so the thought of dragging and dropping it onto a form that magically creates this stuff, it will do some of that for you in the bits, but that's certainly not the workflow that I see anyone really using. It makes for a good mix talk or a bad mix talk, depending on your point of view, but that's not the workflow that is going to really happen, because most situations are people already have their model. They already have the data that they're going after. Very few organizations or people I talk to are going to invent a database schema write directly to RIA services. They're going to have the DAO separately, just like we did back in client server days where we wrote BOs over DAOs, just like we did in WinForms and in a lot of cases we did in ASP.NET. I don't think that story changes. This isn't another data access layer. It's providing services on top of it. And that's why you really can't see RIA services as an ORM. It's not. It's not at all. If it's anything, it's probably closer to something like CSLA, where you're creating these objects that are pulling in from a model and then adding rules around them, whether they're, again, simple validation rules or complex business rules.
So just to drill a little bit more, so if I think about, for example, a classic ASP.NET MVC /jQuery sort of application where you may have sort of the bulk of the business logic living on the server, and you may have sort of a client-side validation tier that's happening in jQuery that sort of gives you validation without having to post back to the server and all that sort of stuff.
Right.
This sort of seems to have some, flavor of that, but it's sort of more in the middle ground, like maybe they're trying to push more business rules onto the client tier, but not all the business rules because can't handle that complexity. I'm just trying to kind of understand, like, really what... what are they shooting for here? Is it just that sort of validation level, or do they really want to go much deeper than that?
Well, I think longer term they want to go deeper than that. But let's take the MVC jQuery example. I write some data access logic and then probably some business object code on top of that on the server to build up my HTML and do whatever I need to do to build really the model and then spit it out through the controller to the view to have the view spit out HTML I want. And I'm going to use jQuery in the client to add logic there. And what they're trying to do is eliminate you needing to write the jQuery in the client, that they're going to want to generate the same sort of code that you're writing in jQuery today to do the client-side validation. I don't think they believe that you will ever be able to do all of the same business rules you have on the server on the client, because it just doesn't make any sense. Often it requires lookups back into data stores, which is inefficient over the wire. Sometimes it's fine to send the data back to the server and find out that something has gone bad, but they want to handle some large percentage of the cases. The big deals to where you know that things are too short, that interrelationships between objects have to exist, those sorts of things for you. And that's really, I don't think they're going for 100% business object, business rule story. Is it 80? Is it 70? Is it 20? I don't know what the number is, but they're trying to take care of a larger case for you so that you don't have to do what we do today, which is, I do add service reference to WCF or data services, and then I write some code on top of it to add the required field and the length validation and the, if you put a first name, you have to put a last name, and if you put a junior, there has to be, whatever the case may be. That interrelationships. Oh, today we have to write the code. They want, because you have to write it on the server, has to be validated when it comes through, they want to be able to share that logic with the client. That's all. It's not bigger than that. It's not an ORM. It's not uniquely magical in that way. The way they've implemented to make that magic to make that code generation happen is the magical part that I'm not a big fan of. But what they're trying to do is incredibly difficult. It is something that anyone doing interior development over the last 20 years has wished there was an easier way to do. And there isn't. There still isn't.
To me, in some ways, like the terminology kind of throws me off. Like calling things domain services, for example, like it seems kind of like a misnomer to me, or as a trying to make it something that it's not. You know, what I mean, like if you're talking about shared validation rules between the client and the server, that like to me is a much crisper story than
lipstick what I read. On a pig.
Yeah, I totally agree. You know, at this point, I've tried to get away from the let's argue with the minutiae and try to help them get the story right. Because this has been my opinion. If you've ever listened to me talk on a podcast or at a conference or at a user group in the last 10 years, you've heard me say this story, that I often don't question Microsoft's strategy about technology nearly as I do as much about story. So I like to use the Link as the canonical example. Link comes out and everyone thinks it's an ORM, not a search syntax, right? Or not a query syntax. And Rhea Services is one of those things where, that's not a good name. That doesn't really describe what you're doing. But, you know, by time most of us heard of Rhea Services, we were asking them to go back to Alex Starr, but they weren't willing to.
Well, I think one thing that complicates it is, like, to us, we like to hear, it's easiest described to us as, okay, this is, you know, handling packaging validation rules, packaging your business rules on both sides, ensuring consistency, that kind of thing. But in terms of selling this to, you know, businesses, and especially probably the teams that'll be most excited about this, they want to tell a story. And the story is more like, we'll help you build business apps, or we'll help you build your intranet apps. And so as part of that, then you've got things like one of the things Rhea Services is targeting is, you know, the kind of data grid story and some new controls that work with validation and that thing, right?
Right. But in general, that problem that they're trying to solve is one that exists in Silverlight today. And that's kind of the, what type of error information do you return back? And that's not unique to Rhea Services. They're trying to solve that in a general way. You know, is it the error info object, or is it one that is already compatible with WPF? Do you use the ones that are already compatible with WinForm, since people have code they're already familiar with? That's actually a problem that, in general, the Silverlight guys are trying to solve, not just Rhea Services. And interestingly, when Rhea Services or the whole package was presented to us, it was presented to us as a package, client-side and server-side, and they released the client-side bits as part of the toolkit. You'll see a number of controls, client window, and I think one's called auto form. There's about 6 or 7 controls that they're actually releasing in the toolkit as part of the 3.0 release. It's all the server bits that are really up for grabs. The client bits are actually in pretty good shape at this point. Whether they're misnamed or not, you know, you get 5 developers in a room that won't ever agree on how many spaces are in an indention and how to name a class, you know.
Do we have more questions, or is there more stuff to talk about with Rhea Services?
Yeah, Brian Henderson asked one, but I think we've pretty much pounded it in the head and stomped on its mama. He asks, what unique problems does RA Services have to solve? And I don't know. It's sounding like the same problem that Oslo has to solve, really. Someone at Microsoft is bored and they're getting paid a lot of money.
Well, I'm happy to come on next time and talk to you about why I'm excited about Oslo. But that's a much longer conversation.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's like I'm interested in Silverlight and I want to like play with it some and do stuff beyond just the dancing monkey videos that everyone seems to be doing with it, or the casual gaming. But I don't know. I'm just not seeing a lot of use for it outside of that. But I think it's doing that really, really well. I think that it's doing, you know, video and kind of enabling rich video players and sites like that really well. But yeah, stuff like Oslo and whatever. It's just more smoke and mirrors and stuff that is just either going to be completely misused due to lack of guidance or just a complete non-starter, like Windows Workflow Foundation. And I'm a little cynical about that stuff.
I do think that some of this is addressing exactly what you're saying, right? Because like they've been going after the media because that's a big way to grow market share, I think. And it's kind of a, you know, I mean, you have to have a plug-in to play video. So, I mean, there's no real...
It's a good way to increase download and install base. I'd sure. agree with that.
Okay, so...
But they also...
Forcing everyone who wants to see their team play in March Madness to download Silverlight and install it is a great way to kind of do it. A very monopolistic-like way to do it. But without actually being a monopoly or, you know... abusing your position in the market. People are rushing to be abused. Not abuse. That's a bad word. But anyway, so as you were saying, John.
Have you been drinking, Scott?
No, but the I did go to bed at midnight and the baby woke up at 3:30 because she's sick, so
Well, if you were talking about, you know, dominant market share and all that, I mean, that's definitely not where Silverlight is at purely on that ground. And there's, I don't see that there's kind of a leveraging one thing to push another other than the developer base kind of stuff. But back to what you were saying about, you know, well, it's just, there's no point to it besides video or games or stuff. I think that's exactly one of the things they're trying to solve with this is that, For instance, and I know this, you know, still seems kind of wacky in our world, but like, what if you wanted to write an app that ran a business app that ran both in Silverlight and WPF? You know, for instance, and you know, this might be like, there is actually maybe a use case for Silverlight as a, you know, a good way to build intranet apps. Potentially, I don't know.
Well, I've continued to be of the opinion, and Microsoft will continue to abuse me for saying this, but to me, Silverlight is compelling only when you're crossing the firewall. And the reason for that is that you're living in a very sandboxed world, and you're paying dearly for it. If I have the ability to run inside the firewall, there are other approaches, even in browser like XBAP or WPF, that are more interesting to me than that. What I see from at least my client base, from the people that are coming and taking the Silverlight tour, is that most of them are building line of business apps, and they may be B2B, B2C, or in some ways, you know, the disconnected employee, the salesman that's at a coffee shop needing to interact, or the disconnected team that's trying to do things. Everywhere from, you know, some of it's very rich and nuanced, and that people really want kind of that drag and drop experience of being able to change very rich pieces of whether it's media or textual references or whatever, to really, you know, there's a company in Holland that I've worked with called Schoolmaster that is literally taking their Delphi app that they've been running for years and years and years. They have some obscene percentage of their market, so they don't have a compelling reason to make it better except that they like to write software, and they're porting it all to Silverlight because they know that there's a good percentage use of cross-platform. You know, when the students log in to see how their homework was graded, they're likely to be on a Mac just as they are on a PC. Same in the school with the computer labs are likely to be a mix of both. And so writing an app that they don't have to worry about being on one platform or another is a huge win for them, even though it really is a line of business app. There are lots of data entry screens and forms and things that look like Outlook, you know. Lots and lots of those are being written. Some of them are whole in the browser. Some are augmenting HTML pages. But I don't actually get a lot of people into my class that are building video because the number of people producing video is pretty small. Once you have CBS and ESPN and Disney, you know, and you know, the Fox guys, who else is making video that needs to draft it to the whole universe? No one else. I mean, that's kind of where our media has gotten to. So on a day-to-day level, I think most of what people are using Silverlight for are richer applications where they've had pain in getting the kind of experiences they want in pure HTML. Doesn't mean you couldn't write them, but certainly if you have a company that has a skill set in .NET technologies and isn't, especially if they're not very well-versed in the web, you can imagine taking those guys with C# or VB experience, getting them to learn Silverlight, learn the HTTP stack, and they could be a lot more efficient than having to learn jQuery and HTML. Not saying that that is what they should be doing, but that's, you know, a lot of it is about skill set. And when you look at the competition of Flash, one of the questions that came in, why Flash versus Silverlight, it's all about skill set as far as I'm concerned. It isn't about feature.
So moving on to just kind of more general Silverlight questions, we had a question from Scott Watermasek, who was just recently on the show, and he asked if you had any suggestions or options for working with HTML from within Silverlight.
Well, this is actually an interesting question because I actually ran into a company, I think they're in Idaho, that is using what they're calling one-pixel Silverlight applications. And instead of writing JavaScript code, they're using Silverlight to manipulate the DOM and to handle events and such. I certainly don't think that's a best-case scenario, but one of the things I've always liked about the way Silverlight does its work is that there's a full facility from Silverlight and the DOM. So I can walk into the DOM and I can query the DOM just like I could from JavaScript code, though it's not quite as powerful as, let's say, jQuery. And the reverse is true. I can have JavaScript code call into or fire events that are handled by managed code. And so there's actually a good two-way mechanism to talk between HTML and Silverlight. What they've done is they've built it in a weakly typed manner so that it's very consistent across browsers. But what that means is as you start to deal with the DOM, you need to start going, I wonder what browser I'm on because of the differences between them. But when you do something like getElementById, which is one of the APIs, you're going to give it an ID and it's going to find it in the DOM just like you would, you know, with traditional JavaScript. Again, there aren't things like CSS selectors and some of the things that make jQuery so compelling. But you can certainly get the job done of interacting between Silverlight and HTML.
Just at a very minor level, that was something if I had managed to speak to anyone on the March Madness team, they might have told me that there's some interaction between the Silverlight and the Flash apps on the page just calling right over the DOM bridge. So it works well.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me at all. They did that as well in the MLB stuff.
So Silverlight, you know, obviously the Silverlight 3 was talked about at Mix. They finally kind of announced some of the features that have been brewing for a while. One of my favorite features was kind of a sleeper, which was they're allowing you to directly write pixels on the screen and directly write audio. And I just kind of see that as cool because then you can do, there's never a case where you're backed into a corner where you can't do something. You know, if you're stuck, you can always write your own codec or something. It may suck, but you'd be able to do it. I'm wondering if there's any features that you're excited about out of Silverlight 3.
Well, out of browser got the big mention, you know, being able to run Silverlight apps that are then launched as desktop apps. And certainly, I think that feature probably internally has probably a name somewhere, a twirl killer or maybe tweet deck killer. But if we ignore that, because I think that's gotten probably more press than it deserves, my favorite feature no one's talking about are behaviors. Behaviors are a way that you can package up animations and then apply them. I hate to say animations because that's a little too limiting, but it's really a way to add behavior to objects, whether that's calling out to a method or adding bounds to a visual element. It's a way that we can program in straight-ahead code a small behavior that we can then literally drag and drop and blend onto different elements to get that behavior. One of the really cool demos of behaviors is there's a there's a physics engine behavior that someone has written. So basically you take your business level app that's in the grid in Silverlight, and they put this behavior on the grid. You run the app, and as soon as the app runs, all of the elements on the page start to bounce against each other and fall on the screen because suddenly there's a gravity behavior applied to the entire screen. So the power of building your own behaviors is really impressive because it doesn't require a lot of code and it's very, very reusable. I'll actually be talking about behaviors at DevTeach in June up in Vancouver.
I'm wondering for the other folks on the call, were there any announcements at MIX, Silverlight especially, but otherwise that were interesting to you guys? Crickets. All right. I guess I'll just cut that question.
It seems like there's a lot going on, but it seemed like a lot of it was pretty futuristic.
You mean like time travel and sliding doors futuristic, or?
Like we may never see it futuristic. Like, you know, we're gonna put we're gonna announce it and talk the hell out of it and then not ship it with the downloadable beta, you know, story, whatever that story drawing thing is. Was it Sketchflow? Is that what they're calling
it? Sketchflow, yes.
I spent about 10 minutes like trying to figure out how to find it in the Blend 3 preview before I finally Googled and realized it wasn't actually in there. Kind of annoying, actually.
Yeah, I saw people flying across Twitter saying, you know, where's the Sketchflow? Where's Sketchflow? Which, you know, we could do a whole nother cynical show on, I think. But
yeah, because I'm not a design guy, Sketchflow didn't seem sexy, but I'm not sure I care a lot. I know that a lot of guys out there that are more, you know, I hate to say turtleneck wearing, but I think you know who I'm talking about. They care about this deeply because they have this workflow with their clients they need to work through. And what I've seen, I've been really pretty impressed with. But I think there's a lot of better improvements, like the data generation stuff in Blend is really cool for people that are doing line of business apps. Certainly, even though it's not in the bits again, they're promising it by release and improved text rendering. Finally getting TrueType in Silverlight, because text rendering of small text especially is pretty bad in Silverlight 2 and has driven a number of people away from it.
Well, it's the feedback I've gotten from designers has been that the designer-oriented tools that Microsoft is putting out just does not work with their workflow. Maybe Sketchflow will be a happy surprise for them, but I don't know. The cynic in me still says, you know, they've designed it with their designers internally, and then they kind of unleashed it. And so we as developers are happy with it because it was designed kind of by developers. So of course it's going to fit in our mindset. Whereas, you know, the designers may have a different kind of mindset and way of thinking about the design, and it may not work for them as well.
My experience talking with the Blend team is actually the opposite. Most of the at MIX, I talk to a lot of designers because obviously I get to talk to developers all the time. And what I heard from them was this puts Microsoft ahead of Adobe in the problem space of workflow. Most of the designers I talked to were pretty excited about certainly the Sketchflow stuff, as well as some of the other features. But obviously, Sketchflow got a big piece of their interest. The problem with the other tool space is that most designers I've talked to recognize that Adobe has been sitting on their hands for a number of releases and asking for their $4,000 continually. You know, it's given Microsoft an opportunity to start to compete. They're certainly not going to compete with Photoshop or Illustrator on a one-to-one feature comparison, but they've also had a 15-year head start on it. I have, much like the Silverlight team, I have a lot of faith in the Blend team as well, because I know that they're not talking to me. I went in with 10 features a few months ago and said, this is what you really should be looking at. These are what I'm hearing developers want. And they said, well, that's very nice, but we're not here for developers. We're talking to ad agencies. We're talking about to real designers to figure out what they need, not what you need. Our mission statement is to aid designers, not developers. And I was kind of put back by that. And they've really driven home that mission statement, and that there's a lot of stuff in Blend that doesn't really apply to me, but I don't do that sort of drawing. And on a secondary note, I really think, Scott, you should hang out with Bill Vaughn, because you're both at that same cynic level that makes me look really even-tempered. It's really awesome.
Well, and speaking about, you know, the two things, like, in our shop, we have designers, we normally, they'll build stuff, up till recently, they'd build stuff out in they build stuff in Illustrator and Photoshop, and then they'd hand it over to us, and we'd say, great, and we'd set it up in Blend, and then we'd say, okay, if you want to make any changes, you know, make them in Blend, and then they'd send us another Illustrator file. And then we'd say, okay, but next time, please, you know, just two things that I think, well, I guess three things here that I think are encouraging. One is that they announced that they've got Photoshop and Illustrator import for Expression Blend 3, which is cool. And then for us, I don't know, Sean, if this is similar, but we're finding that using MVVM makes things blendable. So it actually, they can see like that combined with, you know, being able to see design time data, makes it so that it is more usable rather than, you know, go in here and tweak some XAML. And it doesn't really show up on your screen, but, you know, go for it. The one other thing that I'm hopeful is that, you know, actually that Sketchflow is exciting and compelling enough that you'll start a project using it and then just continue on, you know, as opposed to if you start a project with Illustrator and Photoshop, well, that's where your assets are. So the designers are always going to keep going back to that because they're already set up there. But if, you know, potentially if Sketchflow is compelling enough, you actually start doing you start your project in Blend and then just continue on with it. I'd hope.
Well, what I think is compelling, and we don't have a story in the HTML space for this either, is the story of bringing the designer into the developer camp or pushing the developers out the design camp. And what I mean by that is the trick about Blend and trying to talk designers into it, and it is a hard sell, especially in the 2.0 space, is that you should be able to make the changes and not only see them reflected on the screen, but allowing them to do the magic, press F5, and see it actually work in the app. And that's, they're no longer these external resources that throw stuff over the wall. Now, that's a promise it's going to take some time, but I think that's we're certainly getting there. And certainly the TFS integration, which honestly should have been SCC integration, but TFS integration into Blend for 3.0 is a big deal in that way, so that people can simply check out their changes. So designers can check out their changes, make the change, test it with F5, check it back in. That they become part of the team instead of, you know, cowboys out on the ranch.
Right. Okay. Well, we're around an hour, so we could wrap up here. I don't know if anyone wants to talk about any other stuff.
They released something called Super Preview.
Yes. So I tried it out today.
You preview super things in super browsers.
Super Preview.
I played with it today. Right now, the preview of the super preview is kind of boring because it only lets you use like on my machine, I had IE8 and IE6. You couldn't run IE7 and 8 side by side. But apparently that's eventually what you'll get. The overlay mode actually was kind of cool, I guess, you know, where you could like, you could say, okay, let's see the site in these two browsers and what's different, and it might be nice for aligning things because that's flipping back and forth between browsers is a pain in the neck. Did I understand right that the idea is that it'll actually call out to a service that'll render the page for you and send it back, so you don't need to have, like, it isn't actually doing the rendering on your box, it's just using some cloud magic to do it?
Yeah, if the browser isn't installed on your machine. That part didn't ship in the download, though.
Super preview!
Well, the only thing that did ship in the download was IE support, which I was very disappointed in. Even if you have Firefox on your machine, it won't super preview it.
Yeah.
Which makes it not so super.
Well, it makes sense, because what's the only browser you can't run side-by-side?
Yes. IE 7 and 8.
Go on, say it. You know you want to.
Yeah.
And 6.
Sure you can. IE tester.
Yes. Well, that's true.
Super preview 1.0.
Yep.
Yeah, my site looks awesome in IE 2.
Do you mean their IE as well, or an Internet Explorer 2?
Internet Explorer 2. Version 2.
So, before we wrap up, Sean, would you like to plug anything, talk about anything you've got going on?
Sure. I have two upcoming classes. Of course, I do the Silverlight Tour around the country. We're going to be in Chicago on April 6th, 7th, and 8th to teach Silverlight Tour, including Silverlight 3 content. We're going to be showing and using the beta. I also have on March 30th and 31st here in Atlanta, Georgia, lovely Atlanta, Georgia, we're going to be doing our advanced Silverlight course, which includes coverage of Prism, IOC containers, MVVM, advanced data techniques, Silverlight test framework, as well as custom controls and custom containers. You can find all of that at the silverlight-tour.com or Agilitrain, agilitrain.com. There are a couple of articles I've published recently that I'm pretty proud of. One is the recent MVVM article in the March issue of MSDN Magazine. If you're trying to get your head around MVVM, that's a good place to look. There's also I'm doing a three-part series for the Oslo dev team about what DSL should mean for developers, not for architects or you know, kind of Ivory Cloud guys, but actually guys that get work done on a day-to-day basis. I've got two of the three articles done. You can get those at msdn.com/Oslo. And I will have a new Prism for Silverlight article coming out, I believe, in the May issue of MSDN. So if you want to know about composition of applications in Silverlight, as well as integration with IOC containers and on-demand loading of Zaps, that'd be a good place to put it.
Awesome. Okay, well, thanks a lot for staying up late and explaining all this stuff to us.
Thank you very much.
And we'll catch you next week on Herding Code.
Okay, how do I sound?
Pretty good.
Pretty good?
You sound like you're kind of tied up and there's a sock stuffed in your mouth. But I don't know if that's bad.
That's what I'm going for.
Okay.
That was earlier.
Well, thanks, right. Guys. I appreciate you having me on.
Well, yeah. Thanks, Sean.
And I enjoyed the opportunity to make fun of Scott. So,
well, fish in a barrel.
Super preview!